What's next for NASA as it celebrates its 60th anniversary? This month marks 60 years since the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today we'll look back at the creation of the organization that led to the Apollo missions and the landing on the moon. We'll also discuss the current state of NASA, future projects, and potential funding issues. And we'll turn our gaze to other news from beyond our orbit, including the recent aborted mission to send two people, an American astronaut and Russian cosmonaut, to the International Space Station, the search for a ninth planet, and the latest on glitches with the Hubble and Chandra space telescopes. We'll also hear from the editor of the recently released Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA, and the incredible story of human spaceflight. Main Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Broadcasting Radio Studios, I'm Erwin Gratz, and this is Maine Calling. Well, this month marks the 60th year since the formation of NASA. Today we'll talk about the history and legacy of the space agency, as well as what the future holds. We'll also discuss what else is happening in the world of astronomy. Joining me in the studio, Julie Ziffer. She's Associate Professor of Physics with the University of Southern Maine, and Jerry LaSala, Professor of Physics, also with the University of Southern Maine. And joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C., John Logsdon is the editor of the Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA, and the Incredible Story of Human Spaceflight. As always, we want to hear from you. Has your life been affected in some ways by spaceflight? Did you ever want to be an astronaut? What do you think of the prospect of a ninth planet? Our phone number here is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Well, it was exactly 50 years ago this morning that Apollo 7 splashed down in the Pacific, ending the first crewed flight of the Apollo program. It was a mere 10 years after the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is now 60 years old. John Logsdon, the space age, as we call it, began when the then Soviet Union orbited Sputnik, an unmanned satellite, 61 years ago this month. Now, that launch unnerved many Americans because of its military implications, that the Soviets had a rocket powerful enough to reach anywhere in the U.S. The military was already working on some missile technology, and yet the Eisenhower administration's response was to create a civilian space agency, NASA. Why?
Well, it was a debate within the White House on how to respond to Sputnik. President Eisenhower initially said, well, why don't we give all space activity to the Department of Defense and let the scientific community set the priorities for the civilian program? The person that argued against that position, kind of strangely, was Richard Nixon, Eisenhower's vice president, and not so strangely, his new science advisor, James Killian, who was head of MIT. They said it would be better to have a separate civilian agency that was open to the world, unlike the closed Soviet program, and able to cooperate with the scientific community without worrying about classification, and cooperate with other countries in space exploration, while at the same time, the United States carried out a classified military program, and Eisenhower bought the argument and proposed what became NASA.
Your book, by the way, just to let people know, is an interesting compendium of documents from folks along the way through NASA's history, and it does kind of paint a picture at one point of what it was like for T. Keith Glennon, the first person who was recruited to administer NASA. What was it like for him put in charge of this enterprise?
Well, I mean, Dr. Glennon had been president of a moderate-sized university, Case Institute of Technology, now part of Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, and he was used to a few million dollars budget a year, and all of a sudden he had multiple millions of dollars to manage and lots of pressure to do ambitious things. The reaction to Sputnik in the Congress and in the public and in the media was kind of hysterical in terms of the threat to the United States. And Glennon was chosen because he would take a relatively moderate approach to the buildup of our space capabilities. But he had a tough time keeping, on one hand, his congressional overseers, and on the other hand, the engineers who wanted to do things in space, keeping them both more or less under control.
Yeah, and his president, President Eisenhower, who also wanted to, and was not in any pell-mell rush to do things in space.
Indeed. Eisenhower was not convinced of the importance of Sputnik, the importance of space exploration. He said, we don't have any enemies on the moon. We have enemies on Earth. Well, let's not rush off to go to the moon.
Of course, then the change in administrations occurs. President Kennedy takes over, and he begins to see these issues in a different light.
Well, he was convinced to see the issues in a different light. Kennedy coming into office really had not thought much about the space program. And the initial proposals to increase its budget, increase NASA's budget, he said, well, I'm not ready to make that decision. Then on April the 12th, 1961, the Soviet Union launched the first human into space, Yuri Gagarin. And the world reaction and the U.S. domestic political reaction to the Gagarin flight convinced Kennedy not only that he needed to pay attention to space, but that space was of strategic importance. Space leadership was of strategic importance to the United States. He wrote a classic memo, which is reproduced in the Penguin book, asking his advisors to identify for him a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win. So space, dramatic, and win. Answer came back, send people to the moon. And as you say, Apollo 7, the mission that ended 50 years ago today, was the first step in that process of getting people to the moon before the Soviet Union.
How has NASA, the agency, changed over the decades?
Not enough. It still is an agency designed to carry out programs like Apollo, in the sense of a large industrial base, a set of contractors, ambitious plans, but it's operating on one-tenth of the budget of the peak of the Apollo program. And so there's been a constant tension, really since the end of Apollo in the early 70s, between ambitions and resources. And that tension continues even today. So it's an agency under kind of a constant stress to do what it's expected to do on resources that are much less than it would like to have.
Jerry LaSalle, I want to bring you in on this because we were having this conversation just before we went on the air. You have worked from time to time with NASA on projects. What's been your experience?
Well, the last time I was back in the 1990s, but already, and actually for at least a decade before that, NASA was suffering from shrinking budgets. And what I did find when I was there, when we went to meetings to discuss new projects or whatever, it was fairly clear that the primary goal was to make sure that NASA continued to get funding and, if at all possible, to increase it. And the secondary goal was actually whether we could get the scientific results we wanted out of them.
Fascinating. John Loxton, I wanted to ask you, we're coming up next will be the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, which is going to be a very big deal for the first flight around the moon featuring three astronauts aboard an Apollo command and service module. But here's the interesting thing in retrospect. Apollo 8 did fly without a lunar module, in part because one was not ready for test flying yet. And as we saw later in Apollo 13, the lunar module could be a very valuable source of extra resources. If what happened on 13 had happened on Apollo 8, those three astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, would have died.
That's true.
Would modern NASA ever undertake a mission that risky?
It's hard to imagine they would. I mean, modern NASA doesn't have deadlines. The reason that NASA chose to do Apollo 8 And they made that decision basically in a day.
Yeah.
In August of 1968, recognizing the lunar module would not be ready in time for the mission that was planned. George Lowe, the head of the Apollo spacecraft program in Houston, said, well, here's a different way to do it. Fly around the moon and test all the systems except the lunar module. Could the NASA in today's environment accept that level of risk? I'm very skeptical it could or would, just because the environment within which it operates is so different. And we don't have a presidential challenge of before this decade is out. And so there's no reason to take very high risks in moving forward.
You know, I read a lot from the NASA website, and I follow some of the progress on projects like Orion and the Space Launch Systems. And a lot of what I read is about testing and meetings, and it just leads me to wonder whether NASA as an agency has become more bureaucratic now than before, or perhaps the bureaucracy just did what it did in the past and we couldn't read it online before. I'm not sure.
Well, bureaucracy is not a dirty word. I mean, NASA is a large agency, and bureaucracy is a way of organizing large organizations. The problem is it a bureaucracy that can produce results, or is it so set in its ways, so cautious, so limited in its flexibility that it can't perform as well as we would hope it would? And I think that's a bit the case. Again, the lack of resources is a constant challenge, and it's a 60-year-old organization. Organizations get old, get kind of ossified. I think one of the good things now is that NASA has competitors in the United States, in companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, with ambitious programs. So NASA's no longer the only game in town for anything except the kind of space science that your other guests want to do. I think that challenge to NASA's leadership position is a very healthy development.
So what would a modern NASA look like if it were functioning, not the way it was built to function in the 60s during the race to the moon?
Well, there have been a lot of people with different suggestions. It's probably too large an organization. I mean, it has now, I think, 11 field centers, 10 or 11, each of which is located in a congressional district, with two senators and a congressman worrying about the health of that particular center. So it makes it very hard to consider closing any of the existing NASA organizations. And so there's an overhead to the agency that's probably more than we need. It follows government procurement patterns in doing things that have never been done before. There's suggestions that to change some of the existing centers to what are called Federally Funded Research and Development Centers, FFRDC, which operate under different procurement rules and different management practices with a lot more flexibility. They can hire people, they can fire people, they're not civil servants. So there are lots of suggestions for reforming the agency, but the fact that it is a agency funded by congressional committees representing the interests of the places where the NASA centers and the industry are located makes it very inflexible in terms of being responsive to the ideas of change.
I want to talk to my other guests briefly about some of the things they'd like to see NASA do more of. Julie Ziffer, one of the things you mentioned is the idea of smaller research satellites.
Yes, the idea of CubeSats, which are small. There's a box of Kleenex in front of me, and I'm thinking it's a CubeSat. One CubeSat is probably about the size of two of these, and they are very small and can be added to a launch vehicle that's already going up with another space mission. You can add several of them because you'll have margins that you'll want to use that space in an intelligent way. And so you can launch these CubeSats, and what they can do is that they're very small objects that say, there was a lot of press a few years ago about the Rosetta mission, which went to a comet and sent a lander, Philae lander, to land on the comet, and it took an unfortunate bounce, and we weren't able to retrieve more data from it. But it was overall a very successful mission with the orbiter. If you have something like CubeSats, you can place multiple ones on this comet, and you can study the regolith, which is the surface of the comet. You can study it to see how do these things bounce, what types of material and structure is on this comet, so that then you can put a lander on there more successfully. And there's so many applications for these CubeSats, very inexpensive relative to the rest of the budget. You can have lots of them, and they can achieve a lot of science. And I think one of the things that limits NASA right now is this idea of low risk. They search for these low risk projects, but this is something that can be somewhat high risk, but also very high reward. And it can be high risk because it's low cost. So you can put in these CubeSats that might have a larger chance of, or a lower chance of success, a larger chance of failure than anything else, but you haven't lost a lot. If you don't get the success, but you've gained so much if they do. You can use a lot of them. You can drop them on, as I mentioned earlier, you can drop them on Venus and places that traditionally are very hard to go because of the high-risk nature of them.
Hmm. Jerry LaSala, anything you'd like to see?
I'd love to see some of those sent to Venus. I'd love to get some more information on what's going on in Venus. Also, more missions towards the outer planets would excite me.
All right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have some of your comments and questions, and we'll have more with our guests as well. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. And Martin's Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine and New Hampshire. Offering Generations Advantage, the only Medicare Advantage plan ranked 5 stars by Medicare in the state. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
What would you like to ask the candidates for governor, Congress, or U.S. Senate? Here's your chance. Maine Public will be holding 4 Your Vote 2018 debates to be televised and broadcast on the radio. And we will be including questions from you, the public. Please email your question, along with your name and town, to talk@mainepublic.org. Again, that's talk@mainepublic.org. And thanks.
Are you interested in traveling to Sicily? Maine Public Travel is headed to Sicily next May on another of our cultural explorations to this fascinating island. You're invited to join Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz and other friends of Maine Public. Our Many Flavors of Sicily 10-day tour will involve sightseeing, tours, lectures, and music that will offer insight and understanding of Sicily and its people. Learn more about Maine Public's Sicily tour by visiting our website, mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, we're talking about NASA and other space news. Joining me in the studio, Julie Ziffer, Associate Professor of Physics with the University of Southern Maine, and Jerry LaSala, who's also a Professor of Physics at the University of Southern Maine. And joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C., John Logsdon, author of the Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA and the Incredible Story of Human Spaceflight. We invite you to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. John Logsdon, NASA currently does have deep space exploration plans, returns to the moon, eventually traveling to Mars. Are they realistic?
Oh, I think so. I think that the rationale for continuing human spaceflight is to go somewhere. And the moon and Mars are about the only somewheres that in any conceivable time frame humans can travel to. It's been since 1972. December of 72 was the last time humans set foot on the moon, and I think it's much too long a gap between the last voyage of Apollo and the next voyage where not only Americans, but I think international crews go and begin to resume the exploration of the moon. We didn't finish it. We didn't even really get much of a start during Apollo. So there's more to be learned on the moon. And then there's the fascinating question with Mars of whether there was ever life there, whether there might still be some form of extant life on the planet. To me, you need, first of all, large machines, not CubeSats, and there's a limit to what they can do. And eventually, I think you need human explorers to do that.
It seems, though, as you mentioned before, NASA's operating at about maybe one-tenth of its budget when it went to the moon, and especially when I think about what NASA discusses in terms of going to Mars, and it posits Orion as its new interplanetary space vehicle, and I'm thinking we're not going to put four astronauts in a space capsule for an eight-month trip to Mars and something coming back. So it seems like NASA's going to need a lot more resources and a lot more plans to make a voyage like that possible.
Well, that's true. If NASA is going to have a sustainable and high quality program of exploration, it needs private partnerships. Pardon me, and it needs international partnerships so that there is some resource sharing. It needs a new interplanetary spacecraft. You would not, as you say, want to be in Orion for 8 months. You need a larger vehicle for that long journey in the ideal world, but it won't happen in time. You'd like nuclear propulsion to cut down the travel time to maybe a couple of months instead of 8 months. Again, NASA has competition in sending people to the moon and sending people to Mars. Blue Origin is very interested in sometime in the late 20s, sending people to the moon. And Elon Musk has very grandiose plans of a million-person city on Mars beginning in the 2020s. So it may not be NASA only. It may be a combination of private and public undertakings that get us back into deep space.
And perhaps as early as next year, we'll begin to see private companies ferrying astronauts up to the space station.
Indeed. It's about time. I mean, the shuttle has been grounded since 2011, retired, not grounded. And the United States claims to be the leading space power. It's a little embarrassing to depend on somebody else for transportation for our astronauts to a space station where we are the managing partner and paid over 70% of the cost. So it is well past time that we have the spacecraft to go from U.S. soil carrying U.S. astronauts to the space station and eventually beyond.
And, of course, that was all also highlighted a couple of weeks ago when we had the Russian Soyuz attempted launch that wound up being aborted and those two astronauts returning right back to Earth.
Yes. I mean, space is still hard. It may look routine, and the Soyuz transportation system that Russia has developed and operated for many years is a very reliable system. And yes, they had a problem, and that was unfortunate, but everything else worked. I mean, the abort system worked, the return worked, the crew is in fine shape, and they will go again. So I expect us to be flying in the Russian equipment back to the space station within the next 2 or 3 months.
Let's talk about some other stuff that's going on. There are a couple of NASA's great observatories, the Chandra X-ray Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope, particularly, both of which are currently not doing science because of issues they've had. Jerry, can you tell us a little bit about what's up with both of those?
About the Hubble, we have difficulties with the pointing right now because one of the gyroscopes is not functioning. And there are plans to use the two remaining gyroscopes to give us some decent pointing, but at the moment it's still in the shop, as it were.
Hmm. But now, of course, Hubble is not in a position anymore to be repaired by astronauts because of the retirement of the shuttle. Is NASA still confident it will get more science out of Hubble before?
They are hopeful, let's put it that way.
Interesting. And Julie Ziffer, I want to talk to you about something else, too. This is interesting. We were all just starting to wrap our heads around the idea of eight planets in the solar system, and now comes word that astronomers may actually be looking for a large ninth one out there. What's going on with that?
Sure. So I believe the news now is a couple of years old on this, when there was an announcement made by Mike Brown, who interestingly was one of the chief advocates of getting rid of the original Planet Nine of Pluto. What he noticed was that there are a number of large objects in orbits that you wouldn't necessarily expect, or actually what it is was, I think there were originally about six objects that all followed the same types of orbits in such a way that they couldn't be explained without invoking this idea of a very large, massive object in the outer solar system, well into the outer solar system. And so he postulated that there would be this 10th planet, or I'm sorry, this ninth planet. I might prefer to call it 10th. I actually prefer Planet X, as a lot of people do, reserving the Planet Nine for the retired Planet Nine. In any case, several people have been looking for this since the original six objects. I believe that there have been at least, I think there's at least one new one that has been found that also follows this interesting orbit. The problem is that one of the reasons we believe that there may be this 10th planet, or ninth, I keep calling it Planet X, is because of these objects, but there may be some observational bias involved. And we're just not to the point where we know that yet, we need to find more of these objects to be able to pinpoint where this object may be found. But the search is ongoing. It has been now for over a year to look for this object. They've narrowed down where in the sky they think it could be found. So there is a search, and if there is a Planet 10 or a Planet X, I'll get the number right eventually, then I think that we will have more conclusive evidence within the next couple of years.
I mean, it also kind of once again raises the question of whether the quote-unquote definition of a planet is adequate. Jerry?
Yeah, well, I was actually at the IAU meeting, International Astronomical Union meeting, when the planet definition was adopted, when we fired Pluto, as it were. And there's still controversy. Those who want to keep Pluto as a planet or reinstate it as a planet, as my colleague over here.
Right. I am team Pluto.
Whereas I was team anti-Pluto, along with Mike Brown. And the controversial piece of the definition, the first two parts of the three-part planet definition are that it goes around the sun. They avoided discussing planets around other stars, leaving that to someone else to worry about. That it be round, and the controversial step is that it has cleared its neighborhood, which means that there are no other large bodies in orbit very close to it. This was a matter of considerable debate at the time. Basically, the purely planet-exploring astronomers wanted that piece out, but the celestial mechanicians who plot planetary orbits and so on felt that that was very important, and they ultimately won the day. But the controversy is still there, and say there are many who are still pushing for a repeal of that, just getting back to a round object in orbit around the sun, in which case Pluto would be a planet again, although our missing planet would not be 9 or 10. It would be about 16.
Yeah. Right. And I should actually point out that the controversy is not so much a scientific controversy. I think there's a lot of consensus in the scientific community about these points. It's a historical and sentimental controversy. So those of us that, as I said, Team Pluto, it's a respect for Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered it, and for his family. Clyde was still alive when the idea first came up of retiring Pluto. So there's the human aspect to the controversy more than the science.
Yeah. Well, there's one more thing to add. We've now seen Pluto.
Yeah.
New Horizons flew by Pluto a few years ago and revealed a planet with a very complex geology, with a very interesting moon, with all the attributes that we attribute to a planetary body. It's not no longer some very faint speck in the sky. It's a real world.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. I want to get to the phones. If you'd like to join our conversation here, the number is 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Let's talk with Mark in Falmouth. Mark, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We've put a lot of flotsam and jetsam in orbit around the Earth since the late 50s. I'd like to know how many pieces are there? Are they all being tracked? And what kind of a threat do they pose to existing satellites and new satellites that we intend to put up?
All right. That's a good question. Who wants to tackle that?
I can do that.
Okay, John, go for it.
It is a real problem to start out with, and it does pose a threat to existing satellites that people are becoming more and more aware of, the so-called space debris problem. We track about 20,000 objects 10 centimeters or larger. That's our tracking capability. There are millions of objects smaller than 10 centimeters, flecks of paint that at the orbital velocities can cause a fair amount of damage. So it's a very cluttered environment in low Earth orbit and to some degree in the geosynchronous orbit where communication satellites exist. And at this point, there's a lot of talking, but not much action in terms of remedial actions, of cleaning up the debris. There are international guidelines to prevent the creation of future debris. And just to introduce a new topic in here, if there is any kind of anti-satellite activity, if we start shooting satellites down or destroying satellites in orbit, that creates lots and lots of debris that would make the problem kind of exponentially worse. So there's a lot of reason to keep space secure, keep weapons out of space, and limit anti-satellite activity in addition to the debris that comes from civilian activity.
Didn't the Chinese once run an experiment along those lines?
Yeah, January of 2007, they shot at and hit one of their own satellites to demonstrate their it's a particular kind of anti-satellite capability called kinetic kill, which is a jargon word for actually hitting something with another object and destroying it. They've tested other anti-satellite approaches since then, but none that are destructive in the same way. Russia has that capability, and we're relatively quiet about it, but we certainly could do the same thing if we decided to.
Hmm. All right. Let's take another call. This is Maggie in York. Maggie, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling. Oops, wait a minute. Hang on, Maggie. There you are. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank
Sorry
you so
that.
Much for taking my call. I love the show. I love science, and I love the planets. I have a very good friend who belongs to the Flat Earth Society.
Oh, boy.
And Mike, you know, I also have a very good friend who's an evangelical who says the earth was created in, you know, 1267 at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I said, well, you can't explain that from science because there's dinosaur bones and things. You know, God put those there to test our faith. So you're dealing with a faith-based argument, which I can understand, but I don't understand flat earth because they're not talking in terms of religion. They're talking in terms of facts, like empirical science and knowledge. So what would your reaction be, or how would you address somebody who's so sure of this? We're on a disc.
All right. Jerry.
I just think it's a funny question, but...
Jerry, go ahead, take it first.
I'll give it a try. Neil deGrasse Tyson published a picture a little while ago arguing, show this to all your flat earth friends. It's a picture of the moon with a narrow black shadow in front of it. And it says, did you ever see an eclipse that looks like this? The earth shadow is always round during an eclipse, which means the earth itself is round. That's just one example. I've never quite understood the motivation of people who sincerely believe that the earth is flat and keep talking about how we've been lied to all these years, because I don't know what you gain by lying to people and trying to convince them that the earth is round when it's not. No, the earth really is round, of course. And the evidence that they base it on is, they say, well, when I look at the horizon, I hold up a ruler. The ruler looks straight against the horizon. That's just a complete inability to scale what things look like.
But it is why, by the way, I've read that all four-year-olds are convinced flat earthers. Eventually that changes.
Right.
But... anyway, all right, let's go ahead and take...
Just to add one more piece to that, there are somewhere like 560 people, only 560 people that have flown in orbit. Mm. It would be hard to convince them the Earth is flat since they've flown around it.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take another break. First, before we do that, though, a word about tomorrow's show. We invite you to join Jennifer Rooks. She's going to have a conversation about short-term rentals, things like Airbnb, and how different communities have been looking into regulating them. You can email your comments and questions about that to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You can also leave a voicemail before the show. Here's the number for that. It's 207-370-3487. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Otelco, formerly OTT Communications. From phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century. Otelco.com. And Seth Rigoletti, leadership coach, helping businesses and individuals say it simply, clearly, and persuasively. Learn more at SethRigoletti.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the 2018 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability.
These differences are fundamental to human affairs and can lead to conflict even within families, in communities, and between nations.
Senator George Mitchell himself delivers this year's talk in Orono. He takes a look at the socioeconomic factors that divide Maine and the country and how we can build more common ground. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Maine Public News is holding four Your Vote 2018 debates, and you're invited to attend. On Sunday, October 28th, the second congressional district and gubernatorial debates will be held in Bangor at Gracie Auditorium at Husson College. And on Tuesday, October 30th, we'll hold the first congressional district and Senate debates at Bowdoin College in Brunswick. Attendance is free, but you must reserve your place in advance. Please visit mainpublic.org and click on Your Vote 2018, where you'll also find more information, including the schedule. Please note, both Maine Public Radio and television will offer multiple broadcasts of all the debates, and they'll always be available on demand at mainpublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're marking NASA's 60th anniversary and discussing news about space. My guests are John Logsdon, editor of a new book on space exploration, Jerry LaSala and Julie Ziffer, both with the University of Southern Maine's Physics Department. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number here is 1 800 1-800-399-3566. John Logsdon, I wanted to ask you, we were talking a little while ago about CubeSats and robotic space probes, and there's always been a bit of a tension between money spent on human spaceflight and money spent on robotic space missions. Has NASA over its 60 years reached any kind of equilibrium in that debate, or is that one of those things that just continues on?
Well, I think it's a continuing tension with a limited budget of how much you allocate to robotic and how much you allocate to human spaceflight. In the current environment, there is strong attempt to have synergy between the two ways of going into space for some purposes. I mean, you're not going to explore the cosmos with humans now, and really not even the outer solar system. So we're talking about humans versus robots, and it's not humans versus, it's really humans and robots in Moon and Mars and the inner solar system. The tension exists, but I think there's been a working truce for a long period of time. And to be very wonky about it, when the NASA budget is put together in the Congress, in the White House, there's kind of a wall between the human spaceflight and robotic space science programs. They don't compete directly with one another. And the rationale for humans in space is not primarily science. It's primarily national image, national prestige, human imagination, motivation. If you want just science, science and science only, then robotic is probably a preferable way to go. But there's a cliche in the business that you don't give parades for robots. That there is something about the direct human presence that adds a dimension that is worth having.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. This is Heidi. Heidi, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, Erwin and Julie. Good to talk with you again. I'm calling because I have heard that one of the first programs on the NASA chopping block with the new administration is all of those satellites that are looking down to save our planet from climate change. And I want to know where that program is today. And with all of the extreme weather events that are occurring these days, if we can still keep those around.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that of the current status of those satellites. I have not heard that they have been cut, but that doesn't mean that they haven't been. What I do know is that there are several science mission directorates within NASA, and one of those is focused on Earth and has been, and as far as I know, will continue to do so. The way that it does that certainly might change, but within the science community of NASA, it's something that is absolutely supported to learn as much as we can about Earth and Earth's climate, to do that by looking at other planets as well and seeing about their climate, and to try and understand the evolution of other planets and of our own planet in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of climate. We're very interested in weather. So from the scientific community, when we're asking for proposals, when we're looking over proposals, those are definitely things that are high priority. The funding is something else, and it's not something I'm as familiar with.
Okay.
I am.
All right.
You know, and when the Trump administration came into office, there was a fear that it would attack the NASA Earth Science Program because of Mr. Trump's climate denial, and for that matter, Mr. Pence saying that there is not climate change. They've changed their tunes, as has the new administrator of NASA, Jim Bridenstine, who was a climate change denier in his political career. The NASA Earth Science Program is a robust program. There have been essentially no cuts to the program since Mr. Trump arrived in Washington, and it still has ambitious plans for the future. So the fears have not been realized, fortunately.
All right. Let's go to Jim in Wells. Jim, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is a question of cost. Wouldn't it be relatively cheaper to build a new version of the space shuttle considering the weight and the cost of putting into space because of new technology composites, the fact that computers can do 1,000 times more than they could do 30 years ago and they're much lighter?
Okay, interesting question. John Logsdon?
Well, it's not the way we're pursuing it. Let's see. You've got two companies on their own money building new rockets. One of them, Blue Origin, funded by Jeff Bezos, who has a lot of money, is building expendable rockets of the traditional style. The second one, SpaceX, headed by Elon Musk, is now operating a system that it reuses, recovers and reuses the first stage, not like a shuttle, but just gets the rocket back and refurbishes it a little bit and launches it again. But Musk has a new project called BFR, Big Falcon Rocket, which is going to be a massive rocket with wings that will, in very basic ways, be a new space shuttle, employing modern technology, high degree of reusability. So, and Musk has promised this within the next 5 to 10 years. So we'll see.
It's interesting. Are there some capacity? I mean, the space shuttle had its obvious difficulties in terms of the designs and its expensive operation. But did we lose certain capacities when those shuttles were retired?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the shuttle was not just a launch vehicle. It was a vehicle capable of operating in orbit. It was capable, as you mentioned earlier, of going up and servicing the Hubble Space Telescope. Yeah. It was capable of retrieving satellites that had gotten into the wrong orbit, bringing them back for relaunch or refurbishment. It combined cargo carrying with crew carrying. It helped assemble the International Space Station. There were a whole range of capabilities provided by the shuttle that we no longer have. It's unfortunate that it was a complex, fragile, difficult to operate, expensive vehicle because it was remarkably capable technologically.
Hmm. All right. Let's go to Frank in Kennebunk. Frank, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, Irwin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask today's experts about some of the leading research going on with industry veterans like Steve Justice and Lou Elizondo, as well as Hal Puthoff within the organization Pinstarts Academy of Arts and Sciences. I think there's some interesting discussions going on here with regard to research, as well as disclosure regarding some of the more important events over the last 70 years. Thanks so much.
Okay. Anybody familiar with that?
I am not.
No.
No.
Nor I.
Okay. All right. We struck out on
Sorry.
That one. All right.
Sorry, yeah.
You know, if you would like to join our conversation, though, you still can. The number 1-800-399-3566. And I want to take a moment, and one of the things that we did receive prior to the program is actually from our producer, Cindy Hahn's dad. Who wrote to us that he had come to the U.S. from Taiwan to get a Ph.D. and was a postdoc when he saw a poster in the university hallways that said NASA was looking for a heat transfer expert. He writes, "This was me, so I went to work there in 1959. It was right after Sputnik, and he said the government had told NASA to do whatever it took to build a rocket, so a NASA lawyer apparently went to Washington to the Secretary of State to get a student visa waiver so he could stay in the country and worked. And as a result, he spent time working with what he described as a smart, gung-ho group, worked our tails off, and during lunchtime would read Shakespeare." Interesting picture of early NASA there, John Logsdon.
Yep.
Anyway, go ahead.
I mean, NASA tapped the best technical talent available to carry out its initial programs. Now, again, it has competition for some of that talent with the private sector. But in its early years, NASA was the game in town for people who wanted to do challenging technical work. And I think we've lost a little of that edge. And I don't want to say NASA's not full of good people, because it is. But it's a different environment than it was 50 years ago.
All right. Let's see if we can grab one or two more calls before we get done. This is Michael in Garland. Michael, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Okay. That's me?
It's you. You're on.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Michael from Garland. So, you were just getting into what I was wondering about, which is the sort of funding collaboration and partnership between universities, private enterprise, and the government. I'm guessing the government is still probably funding more, but in total, when you put all of those together and take into consideration the collaboration and interconnectedness and sharing of information, where are we now compared to where we were when it was almost all government? And I pass. So
okay,
take
thanks.
The answer off there.
John
Thank
Logsdon,
you.
Are we putting more resources into space now, even with the private companies taken into account?
Well, most of the private companies live off of government contracts. It's venture capital, and there is an inflow of venture capital into the space sector over the past 5 or 7 years, which is very promising. But it's still, I don't want to say minuscule, but it's much less than the NASA's budget is $20 billion a year. The national security budget, space budget, is roughly equivalent, $40 billion a year. The private sector, leaving aside the commercial communication satellite field, probably puts in a couple of billion dollars a year. So it's still dominantly a government undertaking.
All right. We are running out of time. I'm going to ask this pretty straightforward question from Jeff, who's in Cape Elizabeth, who asks, has there been any change in the type of fuel we use to send rockets into space?
Yes, but.
Okay.
Instead of using kerosene, which was the Saturn V moon rocket fuel, we used liquid hydrogen in the shuttle. And several of the new rockets are using methane, but it's still a liquid, high-energy fuel. There have not been innovations in the form of rocketry, of the design of engines. That's one of the big holes in moving into the future.
All right. Great. Thanks to all three of my guests this afternoon for joining us today. Julie Ziffer is an associate professor of physics with the University of Southern Maine. Jerry LaSala, also with USM, where he's a professor of physics. And thanks to John Logsdon, editor of the new book, The Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration, NASA, and the Incredible Story of Human Spaceflight. Nikki Shields ran our board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Erwin Gratz. This has been Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.